Afternoon, good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming. Tonight, I want to share some more words from Mel's book, our teacher's book, Seeing One Thing Through. And I'm starting on page 136, and I'm bringing up this little section, a couple pages long, called Aspiration and Inspiration. It begins on the bottom of that page. Here's the first paragraph. What is it we aspire to in this life? What leads us, gives us direction, and how do we decide? Or do we decide? Aspiration gives us purpose, and inspiration gives us momentum. Two of the fundamentals of Soto Zen are that Buddhas and ordinary beings are not two, and that we practice with no idea of gaining something. That's the first paragraph of that section. And it says a lot. We go through our daily lives, and probably the words aspiration and inspiration don't come up very often. The idea of aspiration and inspiration, the thought, doesn't come up very often. Because daily life, I guess, is objective life. We have things to do, to accomplish, people to see, we're doing things with those people, arrangements to be made. It's all very concrete, very important. It involves planning, execution, and maintenance. And we're busy. We keep busy. And we're so busy, we're not thinking about what we aspire to, and we're not thinking about what inspires us. Now, I guess we must be, to some extent, inspired, because you need to be at least a little inspired just to get out of bed in the morning, because why get out of bed, really? There's no really good reason. You have to have some inspiration to get out of bed, but mostly, really, we're getting out of bed because that's what we do every day. It's a habit. We always get up. Everybody else gets up. That's what you're supposed to do. And what else are you going to do? So habit is a kind of momentum. And here Mel says, inspiration gives us momentum. Maybe inspiration is momentum. And momentum is the energy that pulls us into the next moment of activity. But really, why would we go on? Why would we do anything, really? Now, to be inspired, to feel that our lives are inspired lives, this is something more than what we would usually think we're experiencing. It's something more than the average person's life, probably. The objective world in which we ourselves are objects and things and people are objects is a very compelling world. It can't be denied. It presses in on us. It demands things of us. So we respond to it. And yet, it's very tiring. It's a kind of relentless world. And we can end up feeling burdened by it. And we need some inspiration to carry us beyond this. I actually think that it's a feature of our human consciousness that we need inspiration, that somehow we require this. And that's why I always say, you know, that's why there's art, that's why there's religion, because human consciousness needs these things. We need it to lift us above the daily grind, to show us a more expanded vision of what it is to be alive. It's a necessity. And even if we're not engaging art or religion, there's still the silence of perception. We have the sunshine and the clouds and the flowers and the animals. And although on the one hand, these things are all part of the objective world, also they're not. because they have the capacity to inspire us. If once in a while we actually slow down enough to look at them, to really pay attention to them and really let them in, just perceiving really anything is inspirational if we actually would be there and perceive it. Later on, I'll read you a poem of Mel's. Maybe you read it yourself in the book about the old plum tree outside the Tassajara office that was taken down some years ago. And he writes about the plum tree and how the plum tree inspired him. So we need inspiration. I really think we need it. And that's why there's religious teaching. That's why we're here tonight. That's why we give Dharma talks and listen to them so that we can be inspired. It's really easy to give a Dharma talk because it's so easy to be inspired by the Dharma. You don't have to, have an inspiring talk. The talk on its own doesn't have to be inspiring. And the reason for that is that the inspiration, in fact, is inside of us already. It's there already. It doesn't take much to awaken it. The Dharma talk is just a little reminder. As soon as we refer to the Dharma, we wake up because the Dharma is what we already know. The Dharma is what wakes us up to what's already in us. We hear it because we know it very well. It's in us already. We just forgot. And Buddhism has lots of names for this which is within us: Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha, bodhicitta. But we don't need to call it any of those names. We don't need to call it anything. Basically, it is fundamentally inspiring to be alive. But also, as we know, there's a lot of problems and a lot of burdens. So we need to be inspired to know that we can lay down our burden at any time. And once we do that, the inspiration comes forward. And practice definitely inspires us. And that inspiration gives us momentum. It keeps us going in practice. And what happens is, and I think we all know about this, that the inspiration eventually leads to commitment. And when there's commitment, it's like we put the inspiration that we already felt before in the bank of our heart, where it accrues interest, so that even when we're not feeling it, because of that commitment and because of our heart bank, we go on anyway. And we're glad to go on. We're happy to go on. Even when we're not feeling particularly inspired, we're happy to go on anyway. And that's because we have been inspired in the past, and we will be inspired again in the future. And even though we've given ourselves to this inspiration many, many times, we need it over and over again. And eventually we get to the point where we never forget it. Even when we're not feeling it, we know it's there, just on the other side of our dull mood or our bad conditions. So that's inspiration. Aspiration is something else. Aspiration is a kind of goal, isn't it? Something ahead of us that pulls us along toward it. And the thing about religious practice is that there's always a very, very lofty, vague and immaterial, hard to pin down, essentially idealistic goal. Maybe the goal is goodness or purity or somehow union with or perfect faith in God, or in the case of Buddhism, we call it awakening or enlightenment. That we would become Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Very lofty aspiration. Buddhism has a wonderful quality of making measurable improvements in our lives. People practice and they see a difference. It doesn't even take that long. And that could be a goal, right? To have a better life, an easier life, or to be a better person. But as I say, I think all religious aspirations are always much more than that. Not that they exclude that, but they also include much more. Religious aspirations are fundamentally impossible. That's the characteristic of them. In other words, they're essentially always beyond anything that we could accomplish objectively. I mean, we vow to save infinite beings, we vow to enter infinite Dharma gates, and so on. We vow to become perfect Buddhas, which is not something we really would expect to accomplish in the objective world. And from an objective psychological point of view, it might seem like a really bad idea to have these lofty aspirations, because then everybody's a failure, right? We feel, no, I did not save all sentient beings. I'm a failure. So maybe we should have more realistic goals. But no, I think from a religious point of view, the goals have to essentially be impossible, because we do need to be at one and the same time humbled. It's really good for us to be humbled. And at the same time, to realize that we are to be infinitely expanded. And that's what we are. Because that's what our human mind demands. It won't accept anything less. It demands that we see how flimsy we are, how vulnerable we are as human beings. And at the same time, we are immeasurable, we're vast. And these are our aspirations. And if our aspirations are only within the realm of the objective world, within the realm of what we call the possible, then we'll never escape, we'll never transcend. And we're made that way. We're made to go beyond ourselves. So I often think of religious aspiration as the horizon, the literal horizon. You look up ahead, and if there aren't too many buildings in the way or too many obstructions, you can see the horizon. And the horizon is really very immediate thing for me, because from where I live, I can see the horizon all the time, because I can see the open ocean without anything between me and the horizon but the empty ocean. And so I can see the horizon all the time whenever I look. And the horizon is a beautiful white line, a glowing white line, most of the time, or a lot of the time. And so out there, you can see the horizon and you keep on going in that direction. But since the horizon is not an actual place, the horizon is just a function of our seeing. You never get there. No matter how far you travel, the horizon is always exactly that far ahead of you, drawing you on. I guess that could be very frustrating. If you're trying to arrive, a little bit like Sisyphus or something, the more you go, the farther away it is. It never gets any closer. But when you appreciate the horizon being what it is, it's the opposite of frustrating. It's amazing. It's wonderful. You're always getting there, and you're never getting there. And as far as you go is far enough. And you can keep going forever, and you'll never use it up, because you'll never arrive. And just like inspiration, this aspiration is also, I'm sure, within us. And just like the horizon can get covered up with all the tall buildings and all the other obstructions, this aspiration can get occluded within us, but it's always there. And we just need to awaken it. And again, that's what practice does for us. It awakens the aspiration and the inspiration that are already there in us. And then Mel says, so that's just the first couple of sentences or two. And then Mill says, who decides? Do we decide? And I think the implication is, he leaves it as a question, but I think he sort of means, no, we don't really decide. Maybe the Buddha decides, or just our nature, our human nature decides. Even if we can't figure out how to decide or even know what it is we're deciding on, I don't think we think it over and decide what we're going to aspire to or decide what's going to inspire us as if it were a deliberate decision. Because whatever we were capable of figuring out, it wouldn't be enough. It would be too small and too limited. Because we're so conditioned by our small and limited objective world, which is really a small world without a lot of magic in it. But something in us does decide. And when, if we should be so fortunate that it happens to us, we listen to the Dharma and we take it up as a path for our lives. Looking back, you realize, well, it wasn't exactly something I decided to do. Really, it's because the sound of the Dharma echoes a sound that was already deep inside myself, a sound that the world had muffled so I couldn't hear it. And the sound of the Dharma echoes that sound inside ourselves. And then he writes, and I'm not sure that he did write it this way, but because, books are edited, you never know what somebody actually is trying to say. And it's weird because the next two sentences don't seem to follow exactly. I don't know if you noticed when I read it before. But then he says, two of the fundamentals of Soto Zen are the Buddhas and are that Buddhas and ordinary beings are not two, and that we practice with no idea of gaining something. Now, I had to think for a minute. What do these two fundamental ideas of Soto Zen have to do with what he's talking about, inspiration and aspiration? Because he doesn't really explain. And when you think about it for just a minute, these two ideas of Soto Zen would appear to be the opposite of inspiration and aspiration. I mean, if we aspire to be a Buddha, but we're already Buddha, how do you aspire to be what you already are? And if we practice without any gaining idea, then doesn't that deny any form of aspiration? Any form of aspiration would be a gaining idea, a desire, a goal. So Mel is telling us that we have to see inspiration and aspiration as Soto Zen practitioners in the light of these two teachings. And when we see them in the light of these two teachings, we'll see them differently. And now he goes on to explain more. And this is now the next paragraph on page 137. When we begin sitting Zazen, we may not aspire to become Buddha, but it's not unusual to want something from practice. Suzuki Roshi's teaching never strayed from these fundamentals. Sometimes we confuse no gaining mind with no aspiration or goal. Gaining here is associated with selfishness or self-centeredness. So no gaining means not adding something that obscures what is fundamental. Don't put another head on top of your own. Don't stick some idea of enlightenment on top of your original endowment. So I remember in the Zen Center for years, people were always repeating, no gaining idea, no gaining idea, no gaining idea. It was a kind of mantra, a kind of Zen ideology, no gaining idea. You were definitely not supposed to have any gaining idea. You were definitely not supposed to be thinking that you could get anything out of your practice. Definitely, if you had that idea, you were in the wrong, and you should expunge that idea immediately, or at least pretend you didn't have it, and when asked, deny it. And sometimes I could observe that the effect of this, people who really pay attention to this idea, was to make them kind of lazy and complacent, especially in their Zazen practice. When I first began asking people about their Zazen practice, I was like shocked by how little they were really paying attention and trying to practice. And I was always pretty sure that Suzuki Roshi and Dogen were not telling us to deny or expunge any of our thoughts. And they were certainly not telling us to be lazy and vague without a sense of direction and momentum in our practice. So, yes, of course, who doesn't come to practice with our suffering? Even sometimes you don't realize it. You sort of bump into the suffering later on, and then you realize, oh my God, that's why I'm here. But for many of us, we know that's why we're here. And we're hoping that practice will reduce our suffering, and we find that it does. If we came dispassionately with some abstract idea of Dharma, not hoping for anything, not needing anything, our practice would be dead and passionless. There would be no warmth in it. Of course, we want to end our suffering. And ending our suffering, we become compassionate and caring people. And here, Mel clarifies that the aspiration, this aspiration, is not a gaining idea. That gaining idea means very specifically a selfish idea. Wanting to practice for some selfish self-aggrandizement, some selfish desire to have more or be more than somebody else. I'm more spiritual than you are. I'm purer, kinder than you are. That kind of motivation. But the innocent desire to suffer less and be a better human being is not really a gaining idea. It might be a childish idea in a way, but it isn't selfish. In the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha comes right out and says it. He says, the reason why I appeared in the world as a being who lives and dies and taught suffering and the end of suffering, it's because I realized that human beings are kind of like children. And when I just sort of like came out and showed the actual Dharma, they couldn't see it. That's why I had to pretend to live and die and teach suffering and end of suffering. They were incapable of understanding that we're beyond suffering already, and that suffering itself is beyond suffering. People couldn't get that point. Childishly mesmerized by the objective world, we would never see that. So the Buddha taught suffering and end of suffering so that we would have the incentive to begin and the inspiration and the aspiration to go on. This is probably an irrelevant aside, but I was really interested the other day. I was listening to a podcast about quantum mechanics, not my usual podcast that I listen to, but somehow I bumped into this. And this physicist was really good. He was explaining things very simply. And he said that maybe you already know this about quantum mechanics, but I think it's commonplace knowledge, but I guess I have forgotten it, or I didn't hear it in quite this way. But what he said was this, that atomic particles are not anywhere at all until we measure them. And when we measure them, they are in the place where we measure them. But before we measure them, they are literally nowhere. It's not, and he says this very clearly, it's not that they're somewhere, just we don't know where they are until we measure them. It's that before we measure them, they aren't anywhere. They're nowhere. And that's what the math and the scientific experiments that they've done prove. Even though it makes no sense, it seems to be the actual fact. And so you can imagine why I appreciated that, because it's just exactly what the Buddha taught. That's what he means when he says all dharmas are empty of any objective basis. And that's what the whole awakening of faith was saying, that it's only when we perceive the world that the world comes to be as we think it is. Now, neither the Buddha nor quantum mechanics is saying that there is no world, it's an illusion. They're not saying that. It's just that they're saying that the world has no location and no objectivity. And that's why the objective world that we think we're living in is so burdensome. Because we know, I think we all know, deep, deep inside of us, that the world is not as it appears to be. And we need inspiration and aspiration to be able to feel this more directly, and we need to feel it more directly from time to time. Mill says that what we call a gaining idea obscures what is fundamental. And the ultimate product, of the objective world is our selfishness. That is sort of the ultimate product of the objective world. We make ourselves into an object to be scrutinized and judged, an object that some of us feel compelled to make greater and greater, as great as possible, in order to justify it. No wonder we're suffering so much. Because we fundamentally have alienated ourselves from ourself. But really, we're not those objects we think we are. Fundamentally, we are Buddhas. The next paragraph. When our aspiration is pure, that is, not self-centered, it naturally becomes Buddha's practice. That is why it is important to practice for the sake of practice without expectations. So our goal is not the usual goal of getting something, but rather of letting go. It is not wrong to aspire to enlightenment. What brings us to practice is our own light that needs to be revealed and developed through practice in order to express itself fully. It is like a piece of incense that is burning all the way down. It is the same light at the beginning and the end, and goes through many transformations as it burns. The light and the incense are one column, inseparable. Our original thought of enlightenment is the light that stays with us through our entire life of practice and illuminates our everyday activity. Nothing special. It's a great metaphor, isn't it? The stick of incense. Same fire, burning the whole way down. Our aspiration and our inspiration is that fire that burns the incense. And that fire, as he says, is the light inside of us. The light inside of us that knows who we really are and what the world really is. And we have these words. I think the Buddhist language actually is really good for describing these things. Buddha, bodhicitta, Buddha nature. Designating this light, but we have to remember that these words don't describe it because it's indescribable. It isn't objective. It isn't a phenomenon subject to scrutiny like other phenomena. And that's why we can't have any goal, not because it's a sin to have a goal. Because there is nothing to have a goal about, much less a selfish goal. Which is sort of automatically self-destructive. But once that light is lit, once that incense stick is lit, it will burn. It will go on burning. And it'll be exactly the same fire at the beginning as at the middle all the way down to the end. All the way through, glowing. Smoking too, right? Smoking. And the smoke wafts up and fills up the whole room with fragrance. Back to Mel. Our Bodhisattva practice is to help all beings in their quest for fundamental maturity and realization. Enlightened practice is to stop seeking enlightenment and to practice for the sake of practice, which matures oneself and others as well. Dogen calls this Jijuyu Zamai, self-fulfilling and self-joyous samadhi, which is complete when we let go and extend our light to others. And this is a brilliant and wonderful and fundamental paradox. And it seems just simply true to life from our own experience with practice. We start to practice because of our own needs and obsessions. And we're thinking about ourselves and our own practice. We barely notice the other people. But as soon as you go down the path and go for a while, very naturally this shifts. And you find, to your surprise maybe, that you're actually practicing for others. Your practice is about others, not about you. But this practicing for others is called, as Mel describes here, Jijuyu Zamai, self-enjoyment samadhi. Practicing for others is self-enjoyment samadhi. It's a wonderful paradox. Because you realize that real self isn't self. You never were, you know, yourself as an atomized individual. Yourself as me, myself, me, crouching defensively behind this wall. That was never me. My true self, my true heart, is not behind a wall, crouching. To be with and for others is my own self, my own happiness, my own pleasure, my own enjoyment. And this is a true fact of life. Alone or with others, busy or at ease, my true self, the true heart of the world, peaceful and expansive, is always there. And so, of course, we practice for the sake of practice. We practice for the sake of others, which is what it means to practice for the sake of practice. Now, to be sure, this is more than it looks like at first, because when we say others, to practice for others, we don't exactly mean others. What others, right? Just as when we say self, we don't exactly mean myself, because what self? Throughout the history of our tradition, there have always been bodhisattva hermits who spent their entire lives living in caves for decades, practicing devotedly by themselves. But they weren't alone. They were practicing with and for others. Because others is not a social category. Others doesn't mean other people. I mean, it is other people, but it's also not other people. I'm just saying that bodhisattvas, this kind of sounds like, oh, bodhisattvas are all, you know, extroverts going around hugging everybody and helping everybody right and left. I mean, they might be. They might be. Let's hope there are some like that. But no, bodhisattvas don't need to be that. They can be very quiet and solitary people. But whatever their personality that they've been given in this lifetime and whatever their circumstances, they are never isolated. And they're all the time, even in their profound solitude, together with all beings, and their hearts are always open. Bodhisattvas are always alone, and they're never alone. So now, at the very bottom of page 137, I'll read the rest. Some time ago, I ran across a little kid's book from Singapore called The Adventures of Leo. Rahula leads the way. It's about a boy named Leo. One day his mother said, "Why don't you go to the temple and offer flowers to the Buddha?" So he went to the temple, and behind the Buddha statue was a boy who looked a lot like him and seemed to be his own age, 10 or 12. But he was a little monk named Rahula. He had a shaved head and a robe, and they became friends and they traveled around together. And whenever they encountered a tricky situation, Rahula always gave Leo a message or a teaching about it. They got into fights with some kids and Rahula helped him to understand it. Whatever situation Leo found himself in, Rahula was always there to teach him how to deal with it. Leo and Rahula are like the two sides of one person, ordinary and Buddha. When we are mature enough to let Buddha lead, we can help people. When these two sides become one, we can forget ourselves and teach others. So aspiration is just to find the path and stay on it no matter how difficult it is or how discouraged we may get. Enlightenment includes inspiration and determination that keeps us going. When we fall down, we get back up. That is the rhythm of practice. Negotiating our way through difficulty and adversity gives us the strength and confidence to live our life one moment at a time in faith that we are Buddha, which is what we always say at every lay and priest ordination ceremony. In faith that we are Buddha, we enter Buddha's way. This is our aspiration. No gaining mind, but strong practice to express the way and to embody the way. When you have this, nothing can stop you, even though you have many obstacles and seeming barriers. When you become one with the Dharma, it is transmitted to you by the universe, and you have your own true way. So that last sentence is really great. When you become one with the Dharma, it is transmitted to you by the universe, and you have your own true way. Becoming one with the Dharma is so simple. Just open your eyes and your heart, and then you're going to see, naturally and simply see, the Dharma everywhere you look. And again, maybe the word Dharma is extra. You see, simply, the world and others as they are, poignantly, beautifully, expansively, tragically. It's pretty clear if you read the Mahayana Sutras that they're meant to be understood, as I guess all religious texts are meant to be understood, as mythological descriptions of ineffable reality. So to become one with the Dharma is just to live in this world as it really is, without too much human confusion and fearful projection. And when you become one with the Dharma, you are always receiving Dharma transmission from the universe. Everything is awakening you. Everything you see and hear, and everything you don't see and hear. And when that's true for you, you will have found your way. You will know how you uniquely, simply can live and die. Okay, I close with a couple of poems from Mel that are in this book. There's only two poems in the book, I think, and I'm going to read them both for you. They're really wonderful. First one is called Like Water. I remember when he wrote this quite a while ago, he was very pleased with it and inspired by it. And it really is pretty good. Someone asked me, "What is the practice of a Zen student?" I said, "Like water. Water always seeks the lowest place. It goes with gravity. It takes the shape of whatever boundaries it meets. Sometimes it looks like a cup or an ocean. The sweat on your hands, the snot in your nose, clouds, raindrops, lifeblood constantly flowing in and out of your body. We meet it with plumbing, strong pipes with tight joints. Water is truth. Plumbing must be honest. Water can't be fooled. Water makes everything truthful. That is its pure activity. Sometimes it appears as slime, or poison, or tears. It goes through infinite transformations. When it dries out, it appears somewhere else. It is never lost or gone. It is purified by coursing through rocks and boulders. Water is drawn to the rarefied realms by the sun. Gravity pulls it to the earth. It has the qualities of spirit and matter. Water becomes vapor, becomes cloud, retreats from earth, loses its shape, lets go, returns to the dusty realms to nourish all beings as drops, mud, hailstones, snow, dew. The monk is called Unsui, clouds and water. The Unsui sits upright, doesn't lean right or left, backward or forward, gravity pulling down with all its force, spirit rising up with all its strength, mind open, vast as space, the life force blooming like a flower, equilibrium of all the forces and powers, the unconditional realm in the midst of all conditioned. The lowest place is the highest place. The shape of the cloud and water person is determined by the direction of the wind. Water has no special shape or form. It responds to prayers. Its love pervades everywhere and is not limited by self-interest. Eno says, that one is like the sun, shining light in all directions, illuminating the way, facing challenges, not turning away from difficulties, with purity, like a lotus in muddy water. And then his poem on the old plum tree outside the Tassajara office, which has been gone now quite a long time. I don't remember when they took that tree down, but it's quite a long, maybe even as early as the early 70s, I can't remember, long time. So he wrote a poem about the plum tree. Aged plum tree, venerable old monk, pillar between heaven and earth, silent partner, offering shade and sweet fruit, sometimes noticed, sometimes not, a fixed presence, a background for our comings and goings. How many times have we walked by, feeling your presence, barely aware of the subtle rustling of your green leaves, dancing with the fall breeze, waving at the passers-by for no one knows how many years. Now your time is up. You will no doubt be fire, wood, turning yourself over to ash. Will you remember you were once a tree? That you were once a tiny seed? Or that you were once our long ago silent friend on the green grass outside the Tassajara office? What will become of you? What will become of us? And where will we meet again? In the dream time of our imagination, we will be sitting and swaying in the spreading arms of your branches, getting drunk on your delicious fruit and giving voice to all the stories you couldn't tell. So long, old friend. So, those are Mel's poems. So we're going to go into groups, but before we do that, I want to tell you a few things while everyone is still here. First, I want to note just a very, very sad loss today. This is the time when we're having so many sad losses. And today, I think it was today or yesterday, we lost Robert Thurman, the great Buddhist scholar and practitioner. One of the most powerful promoters and presenters of Buddhism to the West. He started out ordaining as a monastic when he was young in I think the late 1950s or early 1960s. He was just a force, a great supporter and scholar of Mahayana and Tibetan Buddhism, a student and close friend of His Holiness Dalai Lama, an irrepressibly funny and outrageous guy, the most lovable person you could ever meet, and no doubt one of the world's top five talkers. He could talk. He would get started and he would just go on and on and on with maximum enthusiasm, colorfully, for as many hours as you would let him. I never met anybody quite like him. And over the years, I haven't seen him in a while, but over the years, he would come regularly to Green Gulch, and we saw a lot of him, and we saw him in other places too. He was really something, and he'll be very much missed by Buddhists all over the world. I found out somehow I got a link to that they were having like prayers and chants for him today. And I tried to go to it, but it said the limit of how many people could possibly be on this link has been reached. So you can't get in. So I don't know what's the limit for how many people, but there must have been many, many thousands of people who were there today chanting for him. So it's a happy thing to think of his life and a sad thing to think of losing him. So he's certainly added to our well-being, to our list of names we're chanting for, not the well-being list, but the safe passage list. And also I'll remind you again of an important event in the life of our Sangha, our Shuke Tokudo ceremony this Sunday at 5 o'clock p.m. at the church and also online. And in this ceremony, the community is going to ordain five new priests. You know who you are, and probably most of you know. It's one of them is our dear Shufi, who we all know well from being one of our mainstays for our online practice. Ann Johnson from Wisconsin, who's a wonderful, a soulful practitioner and a great sewing teacher. Our dear Pearl from Santa Cruz that everybody knows, and with her husband and two children that we often see online. And dear Denise, hi Denise, I see you're on my first screen, so I'm looking at you, hi. Denise, who I met, I don't know when, in the 1990s when we were both at Zen Center together. And she's a great poetry friend and colleague. I always depend on Denise for her opinions and her help in poetry. And Lini, who is also our Zoom host tonight, from Vermont, who and Canada. So we're really happy to be ordaining these five truly extraordinary women. And so it's a really great thing. So do come to the church if you can, or join us online to support and celebrate these five wonderful people as they commit themselves to a whole life and even subsequent lifetimes of taking care of the Buddha way. And then I'll remind you again that on a lighter and more probably humorous valence, the next evening, Monday after the Sunday at Cleo's Books in Oakland, Denise, Shufi, Pearl, and I will be doing some kind of a poetry and Dharma extravaganza that was invented and designed by Shufi We don't know what's going to happen, but it's bound to be fun. So come to Cleo's Books, CLIO, Cleo's Books, if you can. And Sunday, Monday, today's Wednesday, right? We're talking about next Sunday, Monday. And then on the Tuesday after that Monday night, Kathy and I are going to go off to Brooklyn. It turns out that that's the day we have to go because of different other things. And we're going to Brooklyn to see our family and then off to New England. I have some poetry readings to do, and also I have family there. And that means that I won't be there next week when we're having our last for a while in-person seminar at the church, and we're going to hear from our five new priests. Some of them will be there in person and some of them will be online. Each one will be giving a little talk about their practice in their life. And I'm sorry that I have to miss that. I really was planning on being here, but I realized I couldn't do it, so I'm sorry. And then after that, we're taking our break in July, so I won't see you guys for a while after those events. And in August, Kathy and I are going to be traveling a lot too, so it'll be a while. Jean is going to be there on the next week, the 24th, to host the meeting. Okay, so that's a very exciting time coming up. For now, let's talk about aspiration and inspiration in your practice. What do those words evoke for you as you consider your own practice these days and maybe in the past? So, Leni's going to put everybody in groups. I think we have a little bit shorter time tonight, so maybe 3 minutes, 3 minutes, 3 minutes should be okay. So, we maybe with no discussion afterwards. So maybe in about maybe 10, 12 minutes, about 12 minutes by the time you go in the group and come back, we'll see you in 12 minutes. Thank you for listening to the Dharma Talk, and we'll see you soon.